Welcome to Shattering Myths, the program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of society. To those of you who, like me, have finally come to realize that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. If you'd like to join us in that discussion, you're encouraged to do so. Our number is toll-free, 877-300-7645. Former military chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who was trained in the United States, in the United States, the only concern the American War College had regarding him is that he was a devout fundamentalist Muslim. Well, he is heading for a huge victory, so writes Reuters, in Egypt's presidential election. It is amazing that any journalist from any reputable institution would call what happened in Egypt a victory. He didn't win anything. What he did is lost everything, all credibility. It wasn't an election, it was a charade. 70% of the population opted not to vote. Not only the 60 to 65% of Egyptians who are fundamentalist Muslims, they were ordered by their imam not to vote, just as their imam told them to vote for the Muslim Brotherhood and therefore Morsi in the first actually fair and open elections in Egypt's history. But in this particular case, the imams told them not to vote, and they didn't. And so two-thirds of Egyptians didn't vote. In addition to that, which is really interesting, most of the academics, even though they had a communist on the ticket, there were only two on the ticket, Sisi chose his rival and disallowed all others. His rival was a communist. Even with a communist on the ticket, the intelligentsia boycotted the election too. So the only people that voted was about 25% of the population. Yeah, you'll hear numbers that are 35 and 40 and 45%. It's because Sisi's men created votes. They literally stuffed the ballot box. They weren't stuffing the ballot box to carry the election. There was never any doubt of that. The people that were voting, 90+% of them, maybe even more, were voting for him. Because there's about 9 to 10% of Egyptians that are Copt Christians, and for reasons that defy explanation, they have decided that they're better off with him than they are the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I say that because it's, well, you might think it's obvious that the Muslim Brotherhood would hunt down and kill Christians, and they do. The difference is that with the government of the military stands idle why the Muslim Brotherhood hunts and kills Christians. So it's, and the Muslim Brotherhood is more enraged knowing that the Copt Christians in Egypt were more responsible than any other group for encouraging the military coup, which took them out of power. So they're all the more enraged, and the military government is doing nothing to protect them. You know, there's more Christians being killed, more churches being burned than ever before. But what happened here is the Copt Christians voted. They were told who to vote for as well. And the and a small percentage of the ultra-patriotic Egyptian pro-military bad Muslims, marginal Muslims, if you will, voted. That totals about 25% of Egyptians' population, and that was it. 75% voted no by not voting. That's not a victory. And beyond all of that, of course, Sisi not only got to choose who would run against him, and there was no primary for him to be selected even to run, and he was given the absolute control of disqualifying anyone that he didn't want to run for president. He had absolute control of the media and did not allow any even the one competitive candidate to have access to the media, and the competitive candidate couldn't even have public rallies. And when the communist candidate had poll monitors just trying to ensure that you know, one person, one vote, not one person, 1,000 votes, almost all of them were run away by the military and the government. And it was because they witnessed huge vote fraud, and when they spoke out against it, they were either arrested or sent away with the threat of arrest. There was no victory in Egypt. Only absolute and total disgrace. And the problem here, too, is that the Muslim Brotherhood, who won, you know, about 50% of the vote in the last election, and then you had another 20-plus percent of the vote that was carried by an even more fundamentalist Islamic party, the Salafs, freely electing the most fundamentalist Muslim government possible, which was in the process of imposing Sharia law, which would have been hell. And it was hell for the year that it existed for Egypt. Took them back to the Stone Age, if you will. But this military junta is bloody. It's vicious. It's draconian. It's wholly dictatorial. But it really reminds me of the situation in Iraq with Saddam Hussein versus what America imposed, which is a government that is really orchestrated by Tehran. Iraq was much better off under Saddam Hussein. The world was better off when Iraq was under Saddam Hussein. There was a lot less death. There was a lot more freedom. There was a great deal more prosperity in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was in charge than there is now. And so what do you want for Egypt? I mean, my view is that when your choice is bad and much worse, as it was in Iraq, Saddam Hussein was bad, what we have now is much worse, that you ought not engage. You most certainly ought not participate moving from bad to much worse, as America did in Iraq, as America did in Afghanistan. Not once, but twice. But in the case of Egypt, it would be wholly inappropriate for America to aid and abet anyone associated with the Egyptian government. You can't do it. The military junta, with the thin guise of an election, is draconian. They're merciless. They're deadly. And the Muslim Brotherhood, well, that's the wellspring from which almost all Islamic terrorism organizations have emerged. And so when you're confronted by bad and worse, don't try to side with the lesser of two evils. When you do, you tarnish your own character and soul. We can't do anything to fix Egypt. We can't have any influence in Egypt. We ought not try to have any influence in Egypt. America just needs to chill and to recognize there is nothing we can do to resolve that problem. Just back away. The same thing was really true in Libya. Libya was vastly better off under Muammar Gaddafi. Yeah, Muammar Gaddafi was a three-quarters insane syphilitic that once was engaged in international terrorism plots. But he had become effectively neutered, quiet. There's no reason to depose him. But now that Libya is nothing but a menagerie of armed Islamic gangs, all up to their eyeballs and sophisticated weapons, it's not only a living terrorist hellhole, and therefore vastly worse for the Libyans, but beyond that, many of the Islamic uprisings that followed America's aiding and abetting of the jihadists in Libya are directly attributable to our supply of weapons and to our overthrow of that government. Boko Haram was relatively quiet prior to being armed by the outflow of American weapons out of Libya. Look what it did, and we're still arguing about how our weapons were used to kill the American ambassador wielded by Ansar Sharia, one of the fundamentalist Islamic terrorist groups, that we armed and abetted, that the American CIA was working with. And look at the Central African Republic and the horror that has happened there. Look at the horror that has transpired in Mali as a direct result. So you move south from Libya and you just see the guns falling on that continent and creating so much havoc. We made a bad situation much worse. We're guilty. We ought not do such things. Back away. We can't resolve even the harm that we have done. All we can do at this point is to sever all ties with Qatar. Stop supplying them weapons. Tell the world to stop buying their gas. They are the gun runners for the world. We ought to do the same thing with Saudi Arabia because they're equally culpable. And yet, rather than moving in this direction, we're moving exactly the opposite direction. You know, after breaking Afghanistan, after entering Afghanistan on a pile of lies, making a bad situation infinitely worse in Afghanistan, you know, the president says we want to protect our gains. What gains? There's nothing that's better in Afghanistan than was before we invaded, except there's a lot of dead people, a lot of bombed roads, a lot of tumbled, destroyed buildings, and a whole heck of a lot more heroin being grown. A lot more girls being tortured. But now he says to preserve those imaginary gains, because, of course, America just loves its leaders to lie when it comes to patriotism in the military. We're going to stay there a while longer. You know how long we're going to stay? I shared this with you last week. Till the end of this president's term. Why? Because he doesn't care how many more people die. He doesn't care at all. All he cares about is his reputation. He knows what's going to happen when America leaves, no matter when America leaves. Taliban is simply going to return and take control. And he doesn't want that defeat on his resume, so he's going to pass it on to the next president. Welcome, Hillary. Welcome back to the Shattering Nest. We're talking about America moving in the wrong direction rather than the right direction. Now, we moved in the wrong direction when we invaded Afghanistan. We pushed the Taliban and Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan where they were doing almost no harm. Yes, I know there were videos of women being stoned, but the number of women suffering in Afghanistan now is far greater than it was then. And we pushed them into Pakistan, which then we allied with as if we didn't recognize that the Taliban was part of the Pakistani government. And now that the Taliban is even more famous, and since the Taliban now is better armed, since they have confiscated so many of the U.S. caravans of war materials through Pakistan into Afghanistan, they are a major threat to the Pakistani government. That's bad, because the Pakistani government has a nuclear arsenal. What we did in Afghanistan from every perspective was counterproductive. Same thing is true in Iraq. Iraq was the toughest place to make a living as an Islamic terrorist while Saddam Hussein was there. And now it is a haven for Islamic terrorism. And by invading Iraq, we gave Iraq to Iran. It had previously been Iran's enemy, keeping their nuclear ambitions at bay. They didn't have the funds to develop them when they're trying to survive. But now that we gave Iraq to Iran, everything is peachy keen, and they've increased their influence in the region. In fact, the war in Syria is a direct result of America invading Iraq, giving Iraq to Iran, and changing the balance of power in the region. If you don't believe me, listen to Saudi Arabia. They'll tell you the truth. At least in this regard, we made a bad situation worse. When we started supplying weapons to Syria through either Saudi Arabia or through Qatar, We took a peaceful protest and we made it a vicious civil war, a proxy war between Sunni and Shia Islam. Several hundred thousand people have died. More than that have been raped. Many times that have been exiled from their homes. The country is a shattered ruin. There is no country on earth more responsible for the hell that is now transpiring in Syria than the United States. And yet, we're not apologetic. Instead, we want to interfere all the more. The president announced 2 days ago that he's considering sending American troops into Syria. He says the purpose will be to train the moderate rebels. There are no moderate rebels. It's like saying that there's a moderate jihadist. I suppose the suicide bomber, the American suicide bomber, because he smiled nicely when he was holding his cat in the pictures that are all over the internet of him today, that blew himself up in Syria this past week as a suicide bomber, was a moderate. The al-Nusra Front that wants to impose Sharia law on the world, I suppose they're moderates. Hezbollah that wants to defeat them, I suppose they're moderates. Well, we know that the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria aren't moderates because even the most vicious Islamic terrorists don't want anything to do with them because they're too vicious. So with whom are you going to train? With whom are you going to give weapons? To whom? And this whole myth that there is this is the John McClown myth, that there is a free Syrian army. No such thing. There isn't anybody operating in Syria as a free Syrian army. There are no democratic advocates in Syria. You know, there's Assad and his government, aided and abetted by Hezbollah, which is an Iranian militia. And then on the other side, you have Sunni Muslims from Iraq, from Libya, from Turkey, and from the United States, really from around the world, that have been armed by the United States through Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Qatar. That's the mess. And every time that there's any attempt to create a organization of Islamic rebels, of freedom fighters, all of the rebels, whose boots are actually on the ground there in Syria, all of them say, we'll have nothing to do with them. We are an Islamic organization. Our goal is to follow Allah's orders and Muhammad's example. We are here to reestablish the caliphate. We are here to impose Sharia law. That's what we're fighting for. There is no moderation in any of that. The jihadists are worse than the government that they're fighting. With great fear and trepidation, I'm going to share this story. Men with erectile dysfunction may be able to avoid the awkwardness of a doctor's visit and be able to buy Cialis without a prescription. Yes, indeed. There's a new plan that Sanofi is buying the rights to seek approval to sell Cialis over the counter in the United States. Now, the reason I'm sharing this story is because of the enormous size of the market. I shouldn't talk about enormous size in a Cialis review, but nonetheless, the Cialis last year sold $2.2 billion worth of whoopee pills. And their closest competitor was Viagra, who previously had been larger, in sales. But because they have lost their patent protection in several countries, was just $1.9 billion in aggregate sales. So you've got between the two over $4 billion of happy pills. You know, imagine that. You know, this is not a a product that is being sold in great quantity in the third world. So this is a product that is being sold in affluent cultures. And so, you know, you're probably taking the marketplace, and of the 7 billion people, it may be, a billion or so that would be in the market for such a product. In fact, you have to cut that down because it's only half of the world's population is male, and only about half of that is would even be interested in such a product by age, and so it's probably a marketplace that could be half a billion people, and that half a billion people is spending $4 billion. On this product, it says a lot about our focus these days, doesn't it? There's another item in the news that I thought I'd share. Canadian drug maker Valeant Pharmaceuticals International raised the cash component of its unsolicited offer. That means that it's they're that the company that they're trying to buy, which is Allergan, isn't marketing Allergan for sale. They're just, it's a public company, and they're doing what's called a hostile takeover. Well, they raised their bid for Allergan Inc. to $50 billion. They're willing to pay $50 billion. Valeant Pharmaceuticals is for Allergan. Do you know what Allergan makes? Botox. That's their product, Botox. You know what Botox does? It's a poison. I think it's derived from snake poison. But it creates swelling that can enhance features used primarily by women who want to either make their lips larger or they wish to eliminate wrinkles. You know, the swelling from the reaction to the poison will expand the skin, and therefore the creases that are wrinkles seem to be less noticeable. Now, can you imagine that a company that sells poison for your face, primarily used in the face, is worth $50 billion? It's, again, it is a major statement on our society. The French government, a couple of years ago, was the French people, 2 years ago, were really upset about the fact of imposed austerity. Now, was there really any austerity? No, of course not. Not in France. I mean, in France, work week is very short. The days that you get off are extraordinary. There are long breaks in the middle of the day. I think it's like a 35-hour work week. No one can work longer than that. Extraordinarily high minimum wage. I mean, every burden that you could put on enterprise in France is there. I mean, it is a very difficult place to produce anything, extraordinarily burdened. And so the deficits in France to support the socialistic agenda were driving up the country's collective debt. Now, it's not as out of line as America. America was one of the two or three worst nations in the world in terms of debt to GDP. But nonetheless, it was significant. And so there was talk about having to reduce government spending to keep the country from going bankrupt and being thrown out of the European Union and the euro currency. And the masses of France said, no, you can't take away any of our entitlements. We don't want to work anymore. We don't want to be paid any less. And so, and we want all of these the societal safety nets that we've come to, you know, depend on here in France. And so they elected Holliday as a communist prime minister, president, prime minister. I think he is president. And the thing that Holliday said, okay, we won't cut any government spending. We'll leave all the entitlements intact. What we're going to do instead is we're going to substantially raise taxes. As a matter of fact, we're going to raise taxes to the point that if you make over €1 million, we're going to take away 70% of what you made. You know, paying your fair share. If you make over €1 million, we're going to confiscate 70% of it. You can deal with the remaining 30%. Well, guess what? It didn't work. The estimates of revenue by the French government are off by a scant €14 billion, almost $20 billion US dollars. Francois Holliday has raised the income tax. He's raised the value added tax. He's raised the corporate tax. He's done everything he can in terms of raising the tax rates, and he's bringing in less tax revenue. Why do you suppose that is? You ever heard of the Laffer curve? That there is a direct relationship between raising taxes to a level that becomes confiscatory, where people are disincentivized from working, from investing, where no matter how much you raise tax above that point, you actually take in less tax. For example, America's corporate tax is amongst the highest in the world. And so America actually takes in less corporate tax with the high rates than it would with lower rates, because there's fewer corporations that are successful in America. They're disincentivized from investing in plants and equipment and sales and distribution in America. Well, that's what happened in France. He raised every form of tax, income tax, the value-added tax, and corporate tax. And what happened is that he received less tax. Those who are opposing his very poor showing in the last midterm elections, he just got, his party got hammered. And those opposing him said, too much tax kills tax. It's the Laffer curve. It is the basis of supply-side economics that the liberal media and liberal politicians want to pound as a myth. They want to call it trickle-down, when in fact it works. It worked with Reagan. It always prevails. And the Laffer curve does not lie. Glenn, welcome.
Good morning, Adam. Hey. Oh, boy, about that Cialis thing, you know, what happened there was for years, because Viagra was the first one to market, Cialis had a really hard time gaining market penetration, and it took them a long time to get a larger number of sales, but they had trouble keeping it up. So they finally had to resort to, try to go to the over-the-counter market.
Thank you, Glenn. I knew I shouldn't have gone there. I don't even want to. There are so many puns, none of which are going to be helpful in this situation. I'm just going to applaud you for well done, and move on. Yes, to the shrinking size of the French economy.
So. Yes. Well, there was talk. I couldn't understand this the other day. There was talk in France of them going to like 100% taxation. I'm like, how can that even be possible? You know, and how can 70% in any way, shape, or form be equitable? And then I even heard references to like greater than 100%. How can you have greater than 100% anything? It just didn't make sense.
Well, the way they do that is what they did in Cyprus. And that is that rather than confiscating 70 or 100% of someone's earnings, you confiscate their savings. Now, the savings is the residue of what they have earned that you haven't already confiscated. And so when you confiscate, it's kind of like the death tax. It's a tax on a tax. And so that's what they want to do, is to confiscate savings, and they will do it. It's only a matter of time. You know, Holliday has recognized that France is headed for bankruptcy. And so he tried to resolve the problem by appeasing the people, continuing to giving them what they wanted, and then to raise taxes, saying that will work. Well, it's not working. It's having exactly the opposite effect. The French economy is contracting. Employment is growing. The deficit is growing, and tax revenue is declining.
Yeah, people are getting really tired of ineptitude and exploitation. I'm loving this Euroskeptic stuff. It's like, oh my gosh, it's almost a ray of hope, you know?
Yes.
People are finally figuring out, like, that the EU is nothing but, like, a parasite. I mean, the whole thing is parasitic.
I would be hopeful if a study of what happened in France and why it happened would be taken to heart in America. If America would do the same thing, then we would radically change the federal government. We would radically change our tax system. We would hugely lower tax rates, and we would just absolutely slash spending. All you Texans out there in Round Rock, there's a 19-year-old man that was accused of selling brownies. He was just not accused of selling. He was an entrepreneur. He was a manufacturer. You know, who says that you can't manufacture goods in America? He was manufacturing and selling brownies, a genuine entrepreneur. Now, he laced his brownies with marijuana and hash oil. I don't have an issue with that, personally. You know, if you want happy brownies to take with your happy pills, that's just fine with me. You know, this notion that alcohol is legal, but the government taxes it, and marijuana is illegal and the government doesn't tax it, that seems pretty stupid to me. You know, you want to decrease the use of something, tax the living crud out of it. I don't understand why we have rules against marijuana. I personally don't use marijuana. You know, I was not gifted with the capacity to perform, inebriated. I need, well, all the faculties that I have available, I do need them functioning. Otherwise, I'm a blithering idiot. Might be even with my full faculty. So I just don't use drugs. But I think that other people ought to have a right to it. Now, the reason I'm telling you this story is, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there manufacturing and selling brownies. Even those laced with marijuana and hashish oil. But The thing that is interesting here is that the police bothered to arrest this man, and they indicted him. And he was found carrying 1.5 pounds of brownies. 1.5, can you imagine that? This guy, I mean, he must be a major distributor, probably has a 100,000-square-foot warehouse and manufacturing facility there in Round Rock, Texas. He was toting 1.5 pounds of brownies, and he also had a digital scale with him, and he had another $1,675 in cash. So he was a big-time operator. They say that he could be facing 5 years to life in prison. Imagine. I mean, is there any wonder that we have the largest prison population of any country in the world? That we have become the ultimate prison state? 5 years to life in prison for 1.5 pounds of happy brownies. What on earth is wrong with us? Why would we even care about such an issue? Glenn, what do you think about those happy brownies? You work in the medical industry. Are they a great threat to our society?
I always think about this issue. I think of all the people who die from car accidents and alcohol-related DUI stuff and everything. And then I think about the people known who smoke marijuana. I've known some people who really did, sort of impair themselves by toking a whole lot of weed over a very long period of time. They sort of become crispy critters and kind of like, wow, in a permanent state of wow. But the vast majority of people are not that way. They, a lot of highly productive people, where he's doing a lot of very socially redemptive stuff, who are type A's, who like to chill out a little bit. I don't see much of his harm in it. And besides, the marijuana smokers don't cause traffic accidents because they're going too slow looking for like a Pizza Hut or a convenience store.
the reality is that if you intoxicate yourself and you do it habitually, religiously, you're going to destroy your life. You're going to become unproductive. I don't care if you're consuming over an abundance of Twinkies, an overabundance of hashish brownies, or it's your favorite beer. Whatever it is that you are consuming in excess is going to impair your ability to be productive. You ought not do it, but you ought to have the liberty to do it. In the case of marijuana, the majority of marijuana users are no more prone to habitual use than are, the Joe Sixpack with his favorite beer.
Here's a good hypothetical for you.
Mm-hmm.
What if our rampage shooters had been smoking marijuana instead of taking SSRIs?
Yeah, really. What if? And, chances are, by the way, that the person that is consuming marijuana is not going to want to be aggressive. They're just going to want to chill out. The person that is consuming alcohol, same thing can be true.